I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A final push to salvage health care reform is forcing President Obama to delay a planned trip to Asia next week. Now he will be in Washington on March 18th, the day he wants a health care bill passed. Word of the president's travel delay comes as House Democrats try to reassure lawmakers who are worried about being ushered out of office and public service in November if they vote yes on health care now. The White House also announced today that President Obama will be back on the road on Monday, this time in Ohio, to campaign for his top domestic priority. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He also writes The Note for ABCNews.com. And Rick, you quote pollsters today who say the battle for public opinion on health care reform is already lost. So what are Democratic leaders saying to reassure and secure those yes votes from their colleagues who are up for re-election?
And those are Democratic pollsters who are saying it strikingly in the Washington Post. They are doing anything they can to try to lock down the votes. And the promises are flying around, and Obama will campaign for you, whatever they can possibly offer to members who are on the fence. They are doing anything they can to try to lock down the votes. They're trying to create a perception that this is going to be a political winner for Democrats. And at the end of the day, I think it's going to be some of the personal lobbying. It has to be President Obama himself saying, look, this is my agenda on the line. This is the Democratic agenda on the line. You have to be with us on this. And most people are still at least somewhat optimistic that they'll be able to get the votes. But as you mentioned, another deadline is going to be lost in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, holding out optimism are folks like Democratic strategist Bob Schrum. You quote him today as saying the Obama comeback could be cemented as early as November, assuming those jobs materialize. Democrats could minimize their losses and hold both houses of Congress. Now, I will never claim to be a political prognosticator, but Schrum seems to be spinning so fast there, he'd probably give a whirling dervish some motion sickness.
I think he's in the minority. And I think the White House realizes that as well. They have been trying to make the case, and Democrats have been trying to make the case, that this is going to be a political winner. There has not been, though, really any evidence that the health care reform is a political winner. We've seen the numbers flatline or go down constantly. White House is happy about some new polls that show an uptick, but even those polls show more people disapproving than approving, although by a smaller margin than have in the past. So it's just a difficult argument for them to make. And one of the things that was complicating it was this deadline. Actually, there was a backlash against President Obama's deadline because there was a widespread perception on Capitol Hill that this trip was primarily about President Obama going on spring break with his daughters. So part of this announcement with the delay is that his daughter and his wife will not be attending. This is just going to be President Obama on a foreign trip.
So in the face of monolithic Republican opposition, did Democrats really have a chance to secure enough votes before that March 18th deadline?
No, there was really, and in fact, there is no bill at this moment of the fixes, the reconciliation fixes that we've heard so much about. It doesn't exist yet. The Congressional Budget Office hasn't looked at it yet. So you need to put that out there, give some members some time to look at it, give the public some time to look at it. Realistically, if that were to drop right now, maybe you could vote by the end of next week. You go beyond that, you say, well, then members are going to have, they're going to be starting to hear the lobbying all over again. The ad wars will be flying. They'll have to judge where people stand on some of the particulars of it. You can't just ask people to fly blind on this. So what the real deadline is the end of the month. That will be the critical time. The end of March, at the end of March, Congress will be on vacation for 2 weeks. They'll be back in their district for the Easter holiday. And that's when they start hearing from constituents. You start hearing, there'll be town hall meetings. You'll run into people at grocery stores or at soccer games. And once that happens, any of the momentum that gets built can easily get lost. And there's a big perception right now among Democratic leadership that you have to get this done by the end of the month because this is the time. And if people leave Washington without this getting done, A, they don't have much to answer for, and B, they are just going to start hearing from so many different voices.
It does seem like there is a lot of activity going on in Washington right now. I mean, we read that Democratic leaders now want to add a measure that would overhaul the federal student loan program into the health care bill. So how does that fit into that debate, and what other horse trading is going on?
It cuts in both directions. You may gain some votes because a lot of folks would like to see cutting out the middlemen in the student loan system, but others feel like this is going to be taking private sector jobs and throwing them into the public sector in Washington. So it's another complication. It's another piece of the equation that they have to play out there. Earlier in the week, it looked less likely to be part of it. There was new momentum around that yesterday, but it's just one indication of how they will do just about anything to try to get this done. They'll add or subtract, do whatever they need to get done.
Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He also writes The Note for ABCNews.com. And Rick, thank you as always.
Thank you.
We now bring you what our next guest is calling the Great Grocery Smackdown. In one corner, the high-end Texas-based bastion of organic and, some would say, outrageously priced produce, Whole Foods. In the other corner, Walmart. Yes? Walmart. The Arkansas-based mega chain has been in the organic business for some years, but now it's launched a little-known program called Heritage Agriculture. Walmart is buying produce from local farmers who grow crops within one day's drive of one of the company's many warehouses. Walmart's critics have long accused the company of destroying local economies, but with this Heritage Agriculture program, could it actually become a force for reviving local agriculture? And when it comes down to it, how good does Walmart's produce taste? That's what our guest aimed to answer when he set up a head-to-head cooking cage match between Whole Foods groceries and Walmart's. And you'll be surprised by what Corby Kummer found. He's senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and editor of The Atlantic's online food channel. Corby, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I have to start by asking you, you admitted in your article that you were one of those epicures who until recently wouldn't be caught dead in a Walmart.
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to get to in Boston. We don't have many near us, and I've been to Walmarts in the past. It is part of my past, and it is now part of my present and future.
It's part of your present, but only by virtue of someone suggesting that you actually go back and check out what Walmart has to offer.
That's right. A number of friends were telling me I had to look into Walmart's sustainability effort, which, of course, I, being right-minded, have always considered greenwashing. Mm-hmm. It's like brainwashing. They're calling themselves green and sustainable, but they're not really doing anything that's green and sustainable. That's the reflex accusation against a large company that's trumpeting its green efforts.
Okay, so I have to say, I bought my $9.99 coffee maker from Walmart. I didn't necessarily think that I'd find organic produce there, so when you went, specifically, what were the pieces of fruit, vegetable, grains, what did you find in the Walmart?
So even though I'm now considered this great defender of Walmart, I would never buy an electronic appliance there. But that's aside from anything. What I was told is that they're now competing with high-end supermarkets, or let's say middle to high-end supermarkets. I already knew about the organic initiative. Kind of everybody in the community knows about everything they're doing with organics. It itself, as everything Walmart does, is enormously controversial because they do it on such a huge scale. And they buy from enormous farms. And the question is, what are the labor practices of these farms? How good is it for local economies in the end? That's where almost everybody, right-minded and foodie, stops where it comes to Walmart. I went not just to have a look at what my friend who wrote a book called The Walmart Effect, Charles Fishman, was telling me was a very interesting attempt to compete with supermarkets, but also to see what might they be doing with local agriculture, and that's why I wound up writing the piece and pulling the stunt I did.
We'll get to the stunt in a minute, the Walmart versus Whole Foods cage match, essentially, that
you set up. Right.
But this locally sourced agriculture is the Heritage Agriculture project at Walmart that you reported on. And I have to say, I hadn't heard of it, and not many people have, I presume. So what exactly is Walmart aiming to do with locally sourced produce?
The reason I had to write this story is nobody's heard of it, because Walmart takes a while to announce something it's doing. And this is in its early stages. But anything in its early stages with Walmart means it's already on what plenty of places would consider a very large scale. Heritage agriculture, what they're talking about is the heritage of a state like my own, Connecticut, that used to have a competitive apple crop. But then Washington State took it over because it was centralized, and now China has taken it over. So their heritage is staple crops that were grown in a state and lost out to the centralized agriculture states and now countries. Let's give those farms, small but also medium and large, that still exist in these states, incentive by saying we will buy scallions from you. We'll buy lettuce from you. It may cost slightly more because you don't have the economies of scale California does, but if we can get it to us and pay less transport because it's coming from much closer to us, very close to one of its so-called distribution centers.
Within the day's drive.
Within the day's drive. That was what they said. It wasn't distance, it was a day's drive. We'll cut down on fuel costs.
Okay, so there's two key things that you raised here which seem to me to fly in the face of the Walmart ethos. And one is the economies of scale, and two is their relentless focus on what they call everyday low pricing. So if you're dealing with a much smaller scale of things, it sounds like you're going to be finding different heritage agriculture products in different Walmarts now, rather than being able to find the same apple anywhere you shop in Walmart. And secondly, so people are going to be paying a little more for these apples or beets coming from local farmers in the Walmart than they would from industrial farms. So how is it that that fits in with how Walmart does business?
No, I don't think they are going to be paying more, or Walmart wouldn't be doing it. The idea is that the savings it can realize because it pays a 2 or 3 days less transport time from California or Florida to its distribution center will make up for any slight increase it might pay to the medium-sized, much closer farmer. No, Walmart won't do anything if it's going to raise the price. They'll never take that chance.
Is the Heritage Agriculture Project something that they're applying to every Walmart in the country, or even in the world for that matter?
Actually, what they aim to do is have 20% of their produce come from this program.
I can imagine that there are some people out there who are listening who are thinking, Walmart doing something that I might actually be able to rally behind? I mean, you said that your friend Charles Fishman, who wrote the book The Walmart Effect, said that the company does a lot of good things that they don't talk about. So is this a general push by Walmart to help local economies, local farmers, or is it just yet another iteration of their overall goal to enter a new market?
If I knew, it would have meant that I'd penetrated the inner heart of Bentonville, Arkansas, which I have not. I know that they seem to be serious about sustainability, and the fact that they do this on the scale they do is significant. That's what Fishman calls the Walmart effect. What they're not talking about, and what all of my friends would bring up right away and have, of course, already, is what are their labor practices? They, in fact, have a protocol, they say, for how the farms they buy from treat their workers. But are they themselves giving their workers insurance? Are they themselves being model employers? It's an enormously controversial question, and I say that not as a euphemism. I say that there are both sides. With everything of its size and the fact that it is doing some pretty laudable programs, especially around sustainability, there really are several sides to this story, and it's easy to attack them for their labor practices, for health insurance, for the effect that they've had on local economies and small stores in the past.
That's Corby Kummer, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, where he's written about Walmart's new local food initiative called Heritage Agriculture. It's a program where the company sells produce from farms located within a day's drive of a Walmart warehouse. But Corby, I presume everybody wants to know, how does the food taste? There is only one way to find out. So after the break, you've got to tell us the results of the great grocery smackdown pitting Walmart versus Whole Foods. We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about Walmart's new Heritage Agriculture Program, a local food initiative where Walmart buys fresh produce from small farms located within a day's drive of a Walmart warehouse. So could Walmart actually give, say, Whole Foods a run for its money in the high-end organic grocery game? And really, how does that food taste? Corby Kummer wanted to know. He's senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine and editor of The Atlantic's online food channel. Corby wrote about Walmart's foray into local agriculture in the magazine's current issue, and he also did a taste test to find out how Walmart stacks up against Whole Foods. And Corby, we're all dying to know by now. You did this taste test in Austin, Texas, which happens to be the home base of Whole Foods. Not sure if Whole Foods had the home field advantage there or not, but describe to us how you set up this great grocery smackdown.
So my friends at Fino Restaurant in Austin, who, like many places in Austin, because that is a right-minded slash leftist capital of the universe, not just United States, decided that there be the same menu prepared with identical sets of ingredients, one bought at Walmart, one bought at Whole Foods. I asked them to do the very simplest possible dishes so that it would be a fair fight. Everybody got two plates of the same dish, and they didn't know which was which. They just knew the ingredients had been bought from two different places.
And the first course, which, if I remember correctly, was a bowl of almonds and pieces of fried goat cheese with a red onion jam. I'm getting hungry already. And the winner?
The winner was pretty clearly Walmart on that. They simply had better flavor and they were fresher.
And the second course, mixed spring greens in a sherry vinaigrette. The winner there?
The winner there, most people called it Walmart. Most people thought that the flavor was brighter of the Walmart grains.
So we're halfway through the meal. Walmart's up 2-0 to Whole Foods produce there. Now to the main course, chicken served with a poached egg on a bed of spinach and golden raisins.
A huge failure for Walmart. Huge victory for Whole Foods. When I had been shopping for the chicken breast at Walmart, I couldn't find anything that didn't have up to 12%, I believe, brine injected. So it might have been organic, natural chicken broth, but it's a flavor enhancer, and it tasted like, as my aromatherapist said, hospital food. And it was awful. It was grayish. It was terrible. The meat I'd bought at Whole Foods cost 25% more, and was dry and had a lovely white grayish fresh taste and was infinitely better tasting.
And just as a little side note, you did spend about $50 more getting these ingredients at Whole Foods than you did at Walmart.
I did, and almost all of the increase, though, was in that chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It was the meat, which would make it a much fairer comparison because Whole Foods competes on many of those prices, surprisingly, with Walmart on its produce, but not the meat. And you really got what you paid for in this case.
And now, in the final round of the Great Grocery Smackdown, dessert.
Dessert was a panna cotta. The vanilla, which looked like it was in a neat jar that had maybe come from the West Indies from Walmart, had almost no flavor and was much too alcoholic. I was really surprised and I have to say disappointed. I expected that to be very close and it was a strong win for Whole Foods.
So Whole Foods overall claws back to an almost tie here overall in the four courses that you made. But overall, we can't escape the ongoing criticism that Walmart faces every day about, you know, their intent and their effects on local economies when they decide to enter new markets. So what's your take on the impact that Walmart may have in the world of organic and local food?
If small-scale growers that have been forced to grow only one or two things in a state because they couldn't grow potatoes, apples, lettuce, herbs, scallions, things that long ago were just out of their reach as far as finding a decent large buyer for, it could help them. I talked to one farmer near Bentonville headquarters in Walmart who had leased a couple hundred more acres. That is a success story if you can ratchet up your operation. The question, and it remains to be seen, is how long will Walmart keep buying from that very farmer? Will they leave that farmer stranded? My impression is no, because they're encouraging farmers to find other markets at the same time. They're not demanding exclusivity, and they're saying, we want this to be robust for everybody. So it'll be actions, and it'll be over time, the effect this has on smaller regional farmers.
Well, you know, one of the popular criticisms of Walmart is, of course, its ubiquity, but that also could be a potential strength here because you mentioned the sort of typical customer that maybe the foodie type that shops at Whole Foods at Walmart is going after. But also, what about all those people who aren't that typical customer who already do shop at Walmart? It seems like they are now being offered the opportunity to buy types and qualities of food that they would otherwise not have a chance to purchase.
I'm really glad you mentioned that because that's the point of the piece and why I wrote it. And it's because it's giving access to fresh food to people who often live in food deserts, meaning not having access to fresh food-only convenience stores. And we just think of that as being in the poorest part of a city, but there are many rural areas that are also out of range of decent fresh produce in a supermarket. This has nothing to do with their labor practices, with the practices of the farmers who are growing from them, with their giving health insurance. And I can't speak to that. And I know that it's a great ongoing problem with Walmart. I can speak to the need for a lot of people on very limited incomes to find fresh produce. And if Walmart is able to supply them and find a market for it, I am all for that.
Well, that's Corby Kummer. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and editor of The Atlantic's online food channel. What's for dinner tonight, by the way?
For dinner tonight, it's a lot of fresh produce that I've bought in local stores. Thank you very much.
Not Walmart sourced this evening, maybe.
It's not local to me.
Well, if it were, maybe next time.
Indeed.
Corby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for more on the great grocery smackdown, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Monday on Here and Now, some say Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner may be the man who saved the economy, but can he fix Wall Street? And still ahead today, remembering Robert Scott. He failed to be the first person to make it to the South Pole, but he is revered as a British hero. We'll hear readings from the journals he left behind. The news is next. It's Here and Now. The official start of spring is about a week away, and for those of us here in the north, slowly moving snow shovels and rock salt back into the basement, our thoughts are turning to warm weather activities, like bike riding. But what if you need a new bicycle this year? Well, producer John Kalish knows just the place to find a bike that will be a guaranteed conversation starter. Okay, John, so where are we? Because this does not sound like any bike shop I've ever been in.
It certainly is not. We're walking through a bamboo grove in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and I am tagging along with a couple of young men from this bamboo bike studio in Brooklyn. And what they do is they actually harvest the bamboo, finding out about people who are complaining about bamboo growing out of control. And then they bring it back to this bike building studio in Brooklyn. They do a two-day workshop in which people pay about $932. And you spend two full days first building this bicycle frame out of bamboo and then attaching all the bicycle components to it. And at the end of the 2 days, you're ready to ride away on your brand new bamboo bicycle.
So a couple of really amazing things there. One is, who knew out-of-control bamboo groves were growing in New Jersey? And the second thing, apparently these bamboo bikes are all the rage in the so-called do-it-yourself or DIY movement. Do they ride as well as a professionally made metal frame?
Yes, I actually have ridden one of these bamboo bikes, and the beauty of them is that the bamboo absorbs a lot of vibration. So personally, I'd love to have one if I had the, 2 days to put into making this and the $932, for the workshop.
But it seems like a lot of the kits or plans and ideas for this DIY stuff is out there on the web.
Yes, the internet has been quite a shot in the arm for the DIY movement, and this website, Instructables, has detailed step-by-step instructions for making all sorts of things yourself.
And it seems like along with biking, there are a lot of other activities that people do every single day that the DIY movement really is having a lot of influence on. Another one in particular is gardening. I don't think I ever associated the sound of a power drill with gardening. So what's going on there?
You're listening to a guy drilling an aluminum plate into the wall of a loft in Brooklyn. The plate is being attached above a window so that they can hang these window farms. Basically, what they do is they recycle 1.5-liter spring water bottles. And if you can imagine a chain of maybe 8 bottles upside down attached to each other, and a lot of plastic tubing and an air pump to circulate a sort of liquid nutrient that nourishes these plants. They are growing vegetables, mostly leafy green vegetables and herbs, indoors.
We've talked about biking, we've talked about gardening, but also it looks like some key leisure time activities have fallen under the DIY spell. Those are the aquatic sounds coming from a pool, and I have to tell you that most people cringed when they first heard that a real estate developer modified 3 of those huge industrial-sized garbage dumpsters and turn them into a swimming pool, but it became the darling of the DIY community last summer, and we understand the garbage dumpster slash swimming pool idea is beginning to catch on.
A lot of people, you know, went, ew, you know, how could you swim in that? But I did. The water is filtered, chlorinated, and the dumpsters themselves were painted and lined with a really thick plastic tarp. So you're not actually standing or touching the dumpster at all. They're refining the design and hoping that this will become a realistic thing that would bring swimming pools to inner cities in an affordable way.
That's Manhattan-based producer John Kalish. For links to all of the do-it-yourself projects we talked about today, go to our website, hereandnow.org. John, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
There are also pictures of that very cool window farm at our website, hereandnow.org. You got to check it out. Just ahead, the story of Robert Scott. He came up short in the race to the South Pole, but he's still remembered as a British hero. His diary details his and his team's last moments. It's truly an amazing story, and you'll hear it coming up in a bit, here and now. In 1912, British explorer Robert Scott failed in his attempt to be the first man to lead a team of explorers to the South Pole. Scott was beaten by a rival team from Norway. Roald Amundsen reached the pole more than a month before the British. But despite failing, Robert Scott has gone down in British history as a hero, largely because of what he wrote in the diaries he left behind. In this reading from Scott's diary by actor Bruce Alexander, Robert Scott records the crushing disappointment when he and the other members of his British team realized someone had gotten to the South Pole first.
About the second hour of the march, Bauer's sharp eyes detected what he thought was a cairn. Half an hour later, he detected a black speck ahead. Soon we knew that this could not be a natural snow feature. We marched on. Found that it was a black flag near the remains of a camp. Sledge tracks and ski tracks going and coming, and the clear trace of dogs' paws. Many dogs. This told us the whole story. The Norwegians have forestalled us and are first at the pole. It is a terrible disappointment, and I am very disappointed for my loyal companions. Many thoughts come, and much discussion have we had. All the daydreams must go, and it'll be a wearisome return.
In fact, Robert Scott and his four fellow explorers never returned. They exhausted their supplies and died in the Antarctic. The BBC's Alan Johnston looks back on the history of a failed hero.
On that grueling return journey from the pole, Scott's party was trudging into gathering danger. 100 years ago, the understanding of dietary needs weren't what they are today. The meagre supplies weren't sustaining the exhausted men, and they were weakening all the time. But much more significantly, they ran into weather that was extraordinarily bad, even by the standards of the Antarctic.
Friday, March 16th, or Saturday 17th. Lost track of dates, but think the last correct. Tragedy all along the line. At lunch, the day before yesterday, poor Titus Oates said he couldn't go on. He proposed we should leave him in his sleeping bag. That we could not do, and induced him to come on the afternoon march. In spite of its awful nature for him, he struggled on, and we made a few miles. At night he was worse, and we knew the end had come. Should this be found, I want these facts recorded. Oates's last thoughts were of his mother, but immediately before he took pride in thinking that his regiment would be pleased with the bold way in which he met his death. We can testify to his bravery. He slept through the night before last, hoping not to wake, but he woke in the morning, yesterday. It was blowing a blizzard. He said, "I'm just going outside and maybe some time." He went out into the blizzard, and we have not seen him since. I take this opportunity of saying that we have stuck to our sick companions to the last. In case of Edgar Evans, when absolutely out of food and he lay insensible, the safety of the remainder seemed to demand his abandonment, but Providence mercifully removed him at this critical moment. He died a natural death, and we did not leave him till 2 hours after his death. We knew that poor Oates was walking to his death, but though we tried to dissuade him, we knew it was the act of a brave man and an English gentleman. We all hope to meet with a similar spirit, and assuredly the end is not far. Sunday, 18th of March. Today, lunch, we are 21 miles from the depot. Ill fortune presses, but better may come. We have had more wind and drift from ahead yesterday and had to stop marching. Wind northwest, force 4. Temperature, minus 35. No human being could face it, and we are worn out nearly. The others still confident of getting through, or pretend to be. I don't know. We camped with difficulty last night, and were dreadfully cold till after supper, of cold pemmican and biscuit and half a pannikin of cocoa cooked over the spirit. Then, contrary to expectation, we got warm and slept well. Today we started in the usual dragging manner. Sledge dreadfully heavy. We are 15.5 miles from the depot and ought to get there in 3 days. We have 2 days' fuel. All our feet are getting bad. My right foot worse. Amputation is the least I can hope for now, but will the trouble spread? That is the serious question. The weather doesn't give us a chance. The wind from north to northwest, and minus 40 today. Thursday, 22nd and 23rd March. Blizzard bad as ever. Must be near the end. Have decided it shall be natural. We shall march for the depot, with or without our effects, and die in our tracks. Thursday, 29th of March. Every day we've been ready to start for our depot, 11 miles away, but outside the door of the tent, it remains a scene of whirling drift. I do not think we can hope for any better things now. We shall stick it out to the end, but we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. Ah, Scott, for God's sake, look after our people.
8 months later, the bodies of Captain Scott, Edward Wilson, and Henry Bowers were found in their tent. Scott had lost his race to the pole and failed to get his men home safely. But his personal courage in the face of overwhelming adversity is never questioned. And for many in his own country, he became a special kind of hero, a heroic failure. A phrase in a letter found with his journal captured the kind of stoicism that the British often like to admire. He wrote, "We took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint."
Violinist Hilary Hahn is just 30 years old. She's been performing with classical orchestras around the world since she was 10. Earlier this week, she was in our hometown rehearsing Prokofiev's first violin concerto at Boston Symphony Hall. She'll be performing with the Boston Symphony Orchestra this weekend. Hilary Hahn is also a successful recording artist. Her Grammy Award-winning CDs include performances of Brahms, Stravinsky, Schoenberg, and Sibelius. But Hilary Hahn has also stepped far beyond the traditional classical stage. Her violin haunts the soundtrack to M. Night Shyamalan's film, The Village. She's fused her classical strings to a more folk rock sound in several concerts she's performed with musician Josh Ritter.
Kathleen Mowbray, Magnificat, your cheating heart. The chords of a covenant king singing for thee, Ark.
But Hilary Hahn, of course, still does classical. Her new CD is called Bach, Violin and Voice, featuring soprano Christina Schaefer and baritone Matthias Goerne. Hilary Hahn joined us in the studio to talk about what it's like being such a young and versatile violin virtuoso.
I still feel like I have a lot to learn, and I always will. It's said that a classical musician's physical peak is usually around 60. So that means that I have another, like, entire lifespan.
One of your signature composers is, of course, Bach. And your new CD, Bach, Violin and Voice, is a beautiful collection of arias and duets with violin. Let's listen to a little bit. This is you and soprano Christina Schaefer performing a selection from St. Matthew Passion.
What happens is the solo violin plays a lot of the themes in an introduction in the aria that the singers will sing later. So when the singers come in with the words and the meaning of the words and all their musical choices based on that, I, as the violinist, have to have set up their part so that it doesn't sound like a total change of mood. But it also has, my part has to work without the words. And then also playing the middle voice when the singers are singing. And I've always liked playing the supporting role, so this is both a solo and a supporting role.
Let me ask you a little bit about the work that you've done outside the world of classical. You performed on the soundtrack of M. Night Shyamalan's movie, The Village. And, you know, I've heard a lot of directors say that the soundtrack is so important to a film that it's actually like another main character. It is another voice in the movie.
What was interesting for me is that the whole movie is basically finished before you do the soundtrack, because with the timings of all the scenes and the precision that the soundtrack has to match the timings with, it's kind of impossible to even write a soundtrack unless a scene is completed. I did have the chance to ask Knight a lot about what his intentions were with each scene, because I could watch the scene, but I wouldn't know what he was trying to convey, and that's what the soundtrack is there for, not to convey the audience's reaction, but to convey the intention.
What I think that example indicates to me is a particular kind of versatility that your career has shown. I mean, you've had other collaborations, for example, with Josh Ritter. People know him as a folk rocker, not exactly a common name in classical circles, but you've performed with him several times. Mm-hmm. And actually, let's listen to one of those collaborations. This is you and Josh Ritter playing his song, Girl in the War.
Peter said to Paul, you know all those words we wrote are just the rules of the game, and the rules are the first to go. Now talking to God is Laurel begging Hardy for a gun. I got a girl in the war, man, I wonder what it is we done.
When you first heard it, and it is a song, it has its own melody, its own lyrics, it's a very well-known song of his. What's the process that you went through, literally, for this particular song, to decide how you were going to occupy those spaces in the music with your violin?
It never works very well for me to write a violin part for a song. It just doesn't sound right. I think that's because I'm not a composer. So I find it's really, the situation really calls for improvisation. I play a few times, I listen to the melody, I think, well, how can I, like, enhance the melody? Is there some kind of counter melody I could come up with? Is there a pattern that I can come up with that'll tie together the whole song? There's a lot of just kind of thinking what all your options are and then narrowing down to the ones that are really going to enhance the particular song.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about another composer, and that is Schoenberg. And of course, sometimes he's been described as a little difficult, but here you are performing the finale of his Concerto for Violin and Orchestra.
I think I wasn't drawn to Schoenberg in general when I learned this piece. I was drawn to the piece. I had worked on Verklärte Nacht, and I remember thinking that when I was working on that piece, people would say, like at lunch, "Oh yeah, you know, he wrote a violin concerto, and it's like impossible to play," and la di da di da, and kind of like dismissive. I remember thinking, but Verklärte Nacht is really hard, but then it sounds really beautiful. So why are people not giving the violin concerto a chance? I want to listen to this thing. So I got a recording, and when I heard it, I just immediately knew how I wanted to play it, and I knew like what I wanted to do with it. And I thought, this is not, like, I don't know what people are saying. This is not impossible. It's not awkward to listen to. It's really melodic and beautiful, but I'm just not hearing it being played that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to see if I could maybe bring that out a little bit more. Like, I knew it was there, but I just had to find my way to it.
Hilary Hahn, we've talked about your experimentation with movie soundtracks and performing with Josh Ritter. So how do you see those non-classical performances fit into your overall evolution as a musician?
For me, it's really important that the work that I do be organic with who I am and represent me. So even if I'm going into a direction I haven't gone before, it still has to be something that makes sense and something I'm really interested in for the right reasons. And I love having conversations with artists. I love working with non-classical musicians because I learned so much that I can bring back to classical music. But by far my biggest influence is my classical colleagues, and I'm really happy to be a classical musician.
Well, that's Grammy-winning violinist Hilary Hahn. Her new CD is Bach, Violin and Voice. Hilary, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a wonderful weekend, and please join us again here and now.